are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
In the early 1980s, William Steele's life took a turn towards the macabre when he quite literally ran into Robert Durst in Midtown Manhattan. Steele was attending a school for locksmithing and security systems at the time. And Durst, the black sheep of a family that controls billions of dollars in New York real estate, decided he could use a man of those specific talents. Little did Steele realize that his new acquaintance was not only the prime suspect in his first wife's mysterious disappearance, but quite possibly the wealthiest serial killer in American history. For the better part of a decade, Steele and Durst maintained what has been called the friendship of mutual usury. As Durst paid Steele for his use of his Brooklyn home to engage in drug and fetish-fueled sex with a variety of prostitutes. As they got to know each other better, Durst boasted to Steele of darker deeds. Were they confessions of rape, torture, and cold-blooded murder, or just the twisted fantasies of a maniacal multimillionaire? Steele didn't know for sure until years later. He's now convinced that Durst is indeed a murderous monster, and he remains haunted by thoughts that he should have done something to stop the fiend before he claimed more innocent lives. In his gripping memoir, Sex and the Serial Killer, My Bizarre Times with Robert Durst, Steele reveals the depths of the Scion's depravity, and he demands justice for Durst's victims and their shattered families. The book that we're featuring this evening is Sex and the Serial Killer, My Bizarre Times with Robert Durst, with my special guest, journalist and author, William Steele. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, William Steele.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me and our audience tonight. Let's talk about right away, because there's so much to cover, a little bit about your background, who you were in 1982. We know that now, though, and you write as well, that Kathy Durst, Robert Durst's wife, went missing in 1982. And you talk about the encounter that you had in 1982 with Robert Durst. How old were you? But more importantly, give us a little bit of the background, your upbringing, a little bit about your parents, a little bit about you before we can talk about this incredible encounter.
Well, to give you a little bit of background about me, I was probably 19 or 20 years old at the time that I met Robert Durst and Susan Berman on the same day. My background at that time, as you said, I was attending a locksmithing school in Manhattan in New York City. And I ran into him literally spilling a soda on him. And he had made a big deal about it. And that's how we met. So my background is having grown up in Brooklyn to middle-class family, gone to college. I got out of that and I went to attend this school because I wanted to be like a James Bond type character. I kind of liked the idea of being able to get in and out of things. And I had ideas possibly for work in law enforcement. And I studied these trades and became very good at it and eventually went on to pervert these skills and became a pretty prolific jewel and art thief all across the United States. I was incarcerated for this. I then actually escaped from prison. I was profiled on America's Most Wanted website. And so my life's had a lot of ups and downs. And so now, while I was incarcerated, I took some college courses and I decided to write books about my life and some of the characters I've met along the way. Well, one of them was Robert Durst, another one, Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. So I decided to make separate books about them because they, in the last few years, you know, came out in the media and everything. And I said, well, my initial co-author, Gary Greenberg, told me, look, write those books first and then just do your life story separate. And so that's what I decided to do. So while I was incarcerated, coming towards my release, a few years before my release, I started writing of my experiences with Robert Durst. And that's how Sex and the Serial Killer came about.
Let's talk about this encounter. You are, like you say, 19 years old in 1982, and you are with your friend Sammy, and you say you literally bump into them. Let's go back to that. It's a very vivid scene that you depict. Tell us what exactly happens, what kind of conversation ensues between the four of you, and tell us who you meet and what is said.
Well, at that time, we were on a lunch break visiting the school. I forget which. It was many years ago, visiting back to the school. And we had gone to a fast food place across the street, and Robert Durst came running down the block, you know, running fast, walking fast with Susan. I, of course, didn't know him at the time, and we crashed into each other. He ended up getting a bunch of soda on his sport coat and kind of went ballistic on me. He blew up on me. This guy clearly reached for a gun, and I happened to be a pretty cocky guy back then. I was actually dealing a little cocaine on the side, so I usually carried a gun. And so I went to pull out my gun. My friend Sammy grabbed me. Susan grabbed him, pulled us apart, and he, you know, I used a bunch of profanity towards me, and he just was very aggressive over a really a nothing incident. You know, that I was a clumsy SOB and all that stuff. So that's how I met him. Then we ended up, Susan diffused it really with him telling him to calm down, and then insisted that he, you know, buy another soda for me. We went in the store, and she was stumbling over herself trying to explain away his irritability and his explosive outburst over really a nothing incident. And this was in Midtown Manhattan, middle of the day. It was very busy. Could have been a shootout right there in Midtown Manhattan. I further detail it in the book. But she tried to defuse the situation, and she got me to the side, and she said, look, his wife was just murdered. He's under a lot of stress. You know, he's under investigation. And if looks could kill, his eyesight, his glare at her, he killed her then. Because though he killed her years later, she slipped, whether it was a Freudian slip or a mistake, and she was stuttering to correct herself and said, no, I mean, his wife's missing. And that's when I knew. I'm from the streets. I'm from New York. I knew this guy was lying. I knew that she was covering for him, and it all instantly crystallized in that early stage. And this was probably a year, maybe a little more or so. I'm not certain. After I had seen nothing of Kathy's murder. I didn't know anybody at that stage. I didn't know her family then. I know them now. But I knew it. I knew something was going on. And so that's how I came to know them and know that he was dangerous and he was going to be a threat to her because she said something she wasn't supposed to say.
But you write about that it was more than that. And that's why I asked about your background. And you said, well, you were dealing some drugs and you're involved with guns. What you write about is that you recognized it seemed like a criminal opportunity. You also sized up the character of this Robert Durst and of Susan Berman without knowing anything about the kind of potential trouble he was in or she would be in later in her life. So there was something that you recognized, and then you seized that opportunity utilizing much more than just charm, didn't you?
Right. My mother was mentally ill, and I've seen people, you know, bully her and have some victimization before she passed away. And so I've always had this thing to be very protective of women and children and the mentally ill. And she was just terrified. I've seen that look before. And so I got her to the side and I insisted that she tell me, you know, what was going on. And she didn't want to. And, you know, I let her see that I had a gun. I said, look, you're terrified of him. You know, what exactly is going on? And she told me the truth. She said, he's, you know, please, I'm very afraid of him. It's possible that he could kill me if I say the wrong thing. So I did see an opportunity. I saw an opportunity to try to get close to this guy. She told me how, you know, he was very wealthy and he's very dangerous. And as my criminal side of my mind kicked in, I was like, okay, here's a guy that I can exploit. Here's a guy that I could possibly blackmail. Here's a guy that I, you know, if it wasn't in this environment, you know, for killing a woman and for terrorizing Susan, I probably would have pistol whipped him right there because she was so clearly scared. I don't know how this ultimately got diffused other than I know years later what he did. So I spoke to him and he was just stuttering all over himself. And, you know, we discussed about what we were doing in the area. And he said that he could always use, somebody with my skills if they were willing to cross the line. And I said, well, what line is that? And he goes, you know what I mean. If you're willing to cross the line, you know how he talks. If you're willing to cross the line, I pay cash, it'll make it worth your while. I have some favors I need done. And, he said, I'm a good man to know in New York City. He's like, trying to hint who he was. I didn't know who this guy was. I knew she said he was wealthy. And I knew he was clearly a murderer at this stage. So I told him, sure, I'll be willing to cross the line if the price is right. So I figured this was my chance to get around the guy, start recording him, try to build up some either blackmail material or an opportunity to turn him in. And so that's what I set out to do. And that's what I did over the course of several years.
We're a little bit ahead of ourselves in terms of you got more information from Susan Berman. Again, you had tapped her for information. You pushed her to get more information. You recognized that she was very, very afraid of Robert Durst, but yet was indebted to him. And so you found out about that Susan had said something about information about another woman from Vermont, a girl from Vermont, and things had gone bad. And he hadn't filled her in with details, but had given her information indicating, and she was worried that there was some murder involved. So you were told that by Susan Berman in subsequent phone calls, and you became confidants, as it were.
Right. I agreed to stay in touch with her because she was so terrified, and just checking in with her, and she was very grateful. She was crying. And then she did confide to me about Lynn Schulze, which is another girl that Robert Durst killed up in Vermont. Not too long ago, well, actually on more than one occasion, the detective up there that's on the case contacted my attorney, wanted to interview me. And it was right in the middle of the Durst trial. I was going out to Los Angeles, and then Durst passed away. So he obviously escaped justice for many crimes for 40 years. And again, I'm getting ahead of myself here.
Yeah.
But yes, so she did. She did bring that to my attention. Then I subsequently saw some photos that looked exactly like her.
Now, you talked about Robert Durst and the kind of information that he imparted you, but he didn't need just, and he wasn't just interested in your locksmithing skills. You talk about your home in Brooklyn, and he came over to your home to party and spend time. What was it like? What did that entail, partying with Robert Durst?
Well, he told me that he needed a place to get away, and for him getting away, I had lived in a nice section of Brooklyn in an upper middle class, very, very quiet neighborhood, very safe and secure area. For him getting away meant even going there away from the glare of the, Manhattan and all the people that know him and his family there. They're a very well-known family. They control the World Trade Center complex, and they have a lot of property under management. Even back then, they were very well-known. So he would bring over call girls, and sometimes drugs, and sometimes I would provide drugs, cocaine mostly. And he would come over and have his little tryst with different call girls there and try to invite me and involve me. And I've recorded some of these incidents and conversations. There was times he would also shoot guns in my basement. And there was another time he had a transsexual there. So he was into anything and everything, and he would constantly try to invite me to that. And I was, with a girlfriend at the time, and I wasn't really into cheating on her, but this is what he did. He did this around me. And I was the whole time he would pay me for the use of either the downstairs basement or the upstairs apartment, depending on what was available at the time. We had a two-family house, and the upstairs apartment was often empty. And so he would do what he wanted there. He would get high, and he would get weird, and he would many times wear a dress like a woman. He was a very, very, very peculiar person and very dangerous. He eventually started showing me some photographs of women that looked like they were dead. One of them, I wish I still had the photos. It looked exactly like the Lynn Schulze from Vermont, dead, posed. Just horrible things. It's very hard to talk about some of the things that I saw. Just horrible, horrible things. And he started coming over with, for example, a bow saw, plastic, different things, restraints, like B&D type things. And he was into that, and he would pay these women, and he would try to involve me or have me watch. And I said, no, I said, you're not really do what you're going to do, but you're not going to hurt or kill anybody here. I don't know what the hell you're into or where you're going with this, but there's a reason, you know, why would he come with all these things? I think back then I was young and I pretended to like him and give a crap, you know, and I think I learned now it's kind of called grooming. So he's probably in hindsight looking to groom me for participation in some of the things that he was into, which was obviously, you know, sexual fetishes and then killing women, sexually torturing women. I know some of the people that he's killed were witnesses or people that are witnesses against him as well. But he also had this thing where he was really, really brutal with women and dogs, by the way. He's killed a dog in my house and butchered the dog up in my house.
Yeah, it's a dramatic scene. You also were introduced to a very important character that you changed the name for the book. Her name is Delilah. You're introduced to Delilah from Robert. Tell us how this works in terms of your meeting with her. What's her character like, and what does she have to say to you?
Without giving too much away so the average person couldn't figure out who Delilah actually is, she certainly knows. People close to this case know exactly who I'm talking about.
Right.
She came involved pretending to protect Robert Durst and then became very intimate in the plans to kill Susan Berman in California. But in between there, I quickly jumped through the story. There was incidents where her and I, because he told her to be with me, you know, we messed around a little bit. We didn't have sex. Like I said, I was with a girl at the time I was faithful to, but she would, you know, want to go shoot guns in the basement and, you know, be naked. I don't know how much she could say on these type of broadcasts, but she was very much into a vibrator. And she was always trying to seduce me and talk me into, you know, doing things to her and her to me. And, you know, we messed around. I don't think she would have did that unless she was just doing his bidding, which, you know, he's like, well, Bill's my friend and do whatever he wants. So she was out to please him.
Now, your criminal activity are not just an act. You have to, that's your enterprise. And so you're doing robberies or burglaries, pardon me, and you're doing some drug running, gun running. So there's various crimes that you're involved with, and also run-ins with the law around this time as well. So, and you're given this information for you to stash this, some of these things. And we've just mentioned a few of the things that he entrusted you with to stash for him. And so tell us just a little bit more of what you saw when you went through those satchels, and also just a little bit about your own run-ins with the law.
Well, as you said, you know, during this period, I was doing very, very high-end burglaries, waterfront gated communities, all across basically the United States. And I had a place where I would hide things in the house under this shoe ledge. And in there, I would have some guns and silencers and ammunition and bulletproof vests, handcuffs, lockpicks. Not that I was using these things, but I was moving a lot of cocaine kilos at the time and doing my burglaries. So I always had guns around me, and I was always wheeling and dealing the guns, bringing them up from Florida to New York, cocaine from Florida to New York. And I would flash things occasionally to continue building his trust that I was to be trusted. But you can never trust me if you're going to tell me that you're into killing women. It's one thing if right. At that time in my life, I'm a man of faith now, you know, I'm not a Bible thumper or anything, but I have a different outlook on life now. But even at that time, if you told me you're into hurting women, what she did, that he was into, I'm not your friend. And if I can get you busted, I'm going to do it. And so I was about making money and not, at that time, in my view, directly hurting people. You know, you kind of justify what you're doing at the time for the money. But no, I wasn't going to let him get away with that. And there come a time where he showed me a lot of photographs and just some really horrible things. And just literally women that were clearly restrained, women that were clearly dead. One of them, I'll never forget, she had double chair. I really detailed this in the book. So if people want more details, they'd have to go to the book. But it's just horrible to recall. But one that really stands out was one of them that I met. And she had double cherry tattoo on her pubic area. And I remember seeing her alive, and I remember seeing photos of her dead and him telling me that he literally ate her. And I was taken aback and mortified and, like, you know, disgusted, and saying that the cherries were the best part. And I just looked at him, and he literally meant that after he killed her, he ate her flesh. So he was, according to him, into a form of cannibalism. I don't know if it was something he sampled or was really into. Years later, when I went to the trial and ran into his attorney, who I knew really very well, in the courthouse lobby, I was there in June during the trial, but it was time of COVID and he wouldn't let us in the courtroom. But I was there and I saw Durst sitting there. And the attorney on a break saw me in the hallway and he screamed at me in front of everybody, "Cannibals!" He was mad as hell that I wrote that book. He was mad as hell that I put everything out there. And then when he came back from break, he apologized. We had a decent discussion. We have all that on video. I have pictures talking to him and everything. But he was very apologetic because of his outburst. But even the bailiff says, "Why is his lawyer yelling at you?" he was into quite a few things that really aren't out in the public domain, I don't think. I gave a couple of interviews a few years ago. There's a few things around. For example, National Enquirer did like 3 interviews with me about this book. So, and then also about Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein.
Let's get back to people that will want to know, which, I mean, it's just a natural question to ask, is why, what was the rationale? You say this person, I don't know if you even say this person was insane. There is some psychotic episodes that you chronicle in this, but what was the reason why he would do this? Entrust you with information, get you to hold on to incriminating, beyond incriminating, damaging evidence. What was his motivation? And what was your plan?
My plan was really ultimately to turn him in, but make money off of him and blackmail him as we went along. What was on his mind? Why would he confide? Why would he trust in me? I pretended to be a kindred spirit. I feigned some interest in what he was doing, but it was just to get him to continue talking, to continue to get him recorded, to build up enough information where I can make money off him and then turn right around and turn him in on top of it. And things quickly got away from me, obviously. But that was the objective at the time. My mind wasn't into really doing anything right, other than seeing him held accountable. So
you talked to Susan Berman and you knew of the situation, that she had information, damaging information about Robert Durst's wife, Kathy. And you knew, and she had confirmed this, you write, that you were aware of, and again, she admitted, that she was the one that made the phone call to where Kathy worked. So you knew why she would be in danger potentially. And then Delilah and Robert Durst come to you with a scheme. What is that scheme? What did they want to discuss with you and your involvement?
Well, this was back in latter part of 2000. He contacted me and she was in the background, you know, back and forth on the phone, trying to tell him what to say, and said they needed to see me right away, that they were coming down to Florida, and where could we meet? And so we made arrangements to meet. We met. There used to be a Ritz-Carlton Manalapan. I think it was Palm Beach, or the next city over from Palm Beach is called Manalapan. So we met there in the parking lot, and he had already put a private investigator on me when I snuck off work release property and was intimate with my then wife. He had a PI taking pictures of us and had sent them to me. And so when he sat down, I could never get the originals back from him, and he could never get his evidence back from me. I wasn't going to give it back to him. I was going to turn the evidence in, the photographs, along with the tapes. As soon as I saw him, he said, "We need to get rid of Susan." And so I had kicked her out of the car. I told Delilah, "You wait out of the car." And I quickly backfisted him in his mouth and hard and split his lip, and he was bleeding and she's banging on the glass trying to get in. I said, "That's for my wife, for taking pictures of me with my wife." I said, "I want my pictures back. I don't need Susan dead." And I was, you know, I had a recording device on me. I'm like, "Why do you want her dead?" And he explained the situation, that she was getting ready to talk to authorities out in California about her role being his alibi after he killed Kathy.
Let's use this as an opportunity, William, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Talkspace. Whatever challenges you're facing in your mental health, whether you're struggling with low self-esteem, body image issues, anxiety, or anything else, there's no one-size-fits-all solution. And with work, school, and relationships pulling you in every direction, it can be hard to find time to focus on what you really need. That's why Talkspace online therapy gives you unlimited access to a licensed therapist so you can set aside time to put yourself first. When your personal responsibilities just seem overwhelming, it can be a blow to your self-esteem. Discussing it with a Talkspace therapist can help you look objectively at your situation, diffusing the pressure you feel and helping you learn to cope more effectively. Though people often face similar struggles, everyone's path to healing looks different. Talkspace has thousands of licensed therapists across dozens of specialties, so you can connect with someone that's trained for just what you need. Instead of a therapist squeezing you into their busy schedule, Talkspace fits into yours. You'll also have chat, video, or audio options for live sessions, so you can get support on your own terms from any device. Get the one-size-fits-one support you need with Talkspace. Sign up today at Talkspace.com and get $100 off your first month with promo code TRUEMURDER. That's $100 off at Talkspace.com, promo code TRUEMURDER. Now, William, what we were talking about is that they wanted you to enlist you to assassinate Susan Berman mob style so that it would look like a Vegas mob hit for retribution for something that Susan had said and take heat off himself. You are playing it that you will help out in this regard. Then a call comes. What happens with that phone call? What did they say to you regarding this hit? And then what happens to you in terms of the law?
Well, they had a plan mapped out where she wanted, she insisted that Bobby, as I call Robert Durst, would be alibied. So they were looking for somebody else to do this. He wanted to do it himself. He said it's best that she's sent home to her father by a friend. So I sarcastically said, you're some, you know, effing friend. You know, you want to kill your friend. So I just let him talk. I let her talk. I let them incriminate themselves further. I was getting ready to go to authorities and I got arrested. I had a time frame and a number to call them back from, a special number from a certain cell phone that they provided. And when I was not able to make that call, they got paranoid about perhaps I was turning them in. But in reality, I was incarcerated. I got locked up in Miami. I was in the jail under an alias. And when I called them, and I said that the phones were stolen. I said, well, the phones you loaned me were stolen. You know, I'm calling you from another number. I had somebody help me with what's called a three-way call, so it wouldn't show up as a jail call.
Right.
And so they just started backpedaling, very, very fearful. They were not clearly speaking at all, you know, and that he said he was going to go to handle that himself. He was going to see her around Christmas time, and that she had agreed. There was some discussions about affidavits. There was a point where I was offered a significant amount of money to sign an affidavit that I didn't know anything about his activities and all this. One of his attorneys drafted. I refused to sign. I probably should have taken the money I was being offered at the time, signed, and then, you know, went and told authorities about him anyway. But I didn't do it at the time. I don't know what I was thinking. I thought I was getting set up. But so he told me, well, she decided to sign the affidavit. Everything's going to be fine, you know, and if not, you know, we're going to handle things ourselves. She's great. We're fine. But they wouldn't say anything else incriminating, no matter how many times I tried to explain away why I was calling from a different number.
Sure.
So I was incarcerated, kind of lost track of everybody and everything for quite a while. And then a few years later, I was able to reach him again. I was incarcerated, you know, in prison this time. And I used a cell phone, which were contraband at the time, but there was guys that had them and they would rent you some time on it if you wanted to make some calls that you did not want the administration to know about, or, you know, the prison investigators, you can go around them and use somebody's cell phone. So I was able to get a call to him, and he was, you know, very surprised to hear from me. And it was around the holidays, and I said, well, you know, tell Susan I said hello, and, you know, Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and all that, because they're both Jewish. And he said, she's no longer with us. And I just, my blood ran cold, and I said, she's no longer with us. I said, well, she's a nice lady. Where'd she go? And he goes, I sent her back to her father. And, you know, if you want something bright, you got to do it yourself. He says, we don't have much more to talk about right now. And I know where you are, and I'll see you when you get out. You know, he pretty much wrapped that call up by being vague. But to me, it was obvious what he was saying. Him sending her back to her father. Her father was Dave the Jew Berman, which was he was a big gangster under Meyer Lansky running Las Vegas. Right. And so her father was predeceased her when she was, I think, 12 years old. And so he was bragging about sending her back to her father. And that was it. That's when I got the confirmation that he indeed did kill her. He also did mention that he sent a letter to authorities, you know, in a subsequent conversation about where her body was. Now, he denied sending anything when he was confronted years later, because I think it was in the Jinx, Andrew Jarecki discovered a letter that was held by a son, or I think her stepson, Sareb, that's his name was.
Right.
And this letter matched the misspelling and handwriting that Robert Durst was known for. And he had told me, I don't know if he told anybody else, that he didn't want her to decompose, and there was a dog there, that he notified authorities, that he wrote authorities anonymously. Nobody believed me. And for years I said, and he wrote a letter, and nobody would listen. But then when the producer found the letter, or a letter with a similar misspelling and the same handwriting, all of a sudden it was additional evidence to that effect. Then at the trial, well, last year after COVID, they resumed his murder trial. He finally admits through counsel that he wrote the cadaver letter, but of course, you know, denied that he killed her. He claimed in the trial that he went to visit her for a staycation, a term which didn't exist at the time in 2000. But he told the prosecutor, and you know, oh yeah, she invited me for a staycation. Well, is that a term she used? You know, I think the prosecutor pointed out to him that wasn't the common vernacular back then. And he says, well, you know, she was ahead of her time, you know. So he just got on the stand and lied. But he did finally admit that he wrote the letter. He said, oh, I went to see her, walked in, she's dead. I got scared I'd get the blame, and therefore I wrote an anonymous letter. Well, I've been saying that for years. So
tell us, you're in prison, and you said you were in prison until about a year ago. So the whole incident of the trial and the arrest, then the delays for the trial due to COVID concerns, and then finally the conviction and then his death. This is all while you're in prison. Well, not all of it, but so much of what went on, the Jinx, which was very instrumental in this case, in this trial as well. When did you find out about the contents of the Jinx?
Well, we certainly don't get HBO in prison. Yeah. So I think it was on some newscast where they mentioned it, and I had been foresaying that for several years. So it was at some point in prison, I guess, when it was at its height of popularity, which was probably a few years before my book was published. It was published in 19. I don't know when the Jinx came out. Was it 15? Something 15?
Yeah.
So, yep. So that's, I've heard about, you know, that, and it just confirmed what I already knew and have been saying. And then, of course, to have him admit it was the ultimate vindication, you know, when he admitted in court, because I'm now friends with the Kathy Durst family, and, you know, I support them and their cause right now, which is litigation against other of his enablers. There's litigation. I don't know that it's being contemplated or filed. They're looking for some sort of resolution, though. I do know that my prayers are with them every time I talk to them. So.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this relationship that has developed. And you do dedicate, and a portion of the profits from this book go to Kathy's Porch Light. Tell us a little bit more about that, but just the relationship and how that came about and what you do share in terms for this relationship.
Well, I was working with an A-list movie producer in California, Bettina Jilloa. And she was nominated for Emmy Awards and She was extremely well known, did some of the biggest movies out there. And she did a movie on Lifetime about Robert Durst. I forget the name of the movie at the moment, but she was a screenwriter for that. I reached out to her and I said, look, I know something about him. I have an outline for my book. You know, would you walk me through this process? My friend is a editor-in-chief, Gary Greenberg, with the National Enquirer. And I want to put this out there. And he's going to help me clean up the book. But can you help me, you know, get this thing made and this and that? Well, she was in touch with the family.
Right.
And I said, well, look, you know, I was wanting to contact them, but I don't know if they'd want to hear from a guy in prison. And law enforcement's not really listening to me because I'm in prison. Would you make an introduction? And they were willing to speak to me. And we developed a friendship over the years. Bettina and I were in the middle of a screenplay and she was going to pitch that to studios. But I became very good friends with them. And I said, look, I even gave them a draft of the book. I said, if there's anything in there that's too hurtful or sensitive, I'll redact it out just for law enforcement or whatever and remove it from the book. And if there's anything you don't want or you would like added and known about Kathy, I will do that for you. So they actually, the family and law enforcement had a copy of my book before it was published. I just wanted to give everybody a heads up and, you know, see if they had any major issues with it or my approach, you know, to the way I explain my experiences with him. So Bettina sadly died of cancer not too long after this. And so I've maintained this friendship with Kathy Durst family members, her brother and her sister-in-law. And they support what I'm doing. And we've just become really good friends. I look forward to spending some time with them. I've only been out a year. Just before I got out of prison, I was offered a TV show on a major network. I can't name the network, but it's about my life and about my books that I'm writing about my life. And so we're looking to, my fiance and I, to go to New York, get married, maybe film some of my TV show. We already filmed 10 episodes. But so, you know, I've been just getting on my feet and they're very supportive and telling my stories. I wrote my second book called Ghislaine, Sensational and Impure, about Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein, about my time meeting them at Palm Beach. And I have a YouTube channel now. If you guys want to visit it and support and subscribe, I'm very grateful. William Steele Author, two E's, William Steele Author. On YouTube, you'll see some of my interviews about these matters. And we're going to start doing a regular broadcast, an interview program. And my website is williamsteeleauthor.com. So YouTube is real important if you'd like to follow me and subscribe.
That's great. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, we were talking about we didn't talk about, but I'd like to talk about your interaction with law enforcement. Sure, you're a criminal, a convicted criminal, and you are in prison. And so in terms of credibility, but who did you talk to in terms of law enforcement? And what was their response to your offer to help out and tell them what you knew?
Well, despite my credibility, because I did have associations with others in law enforcement, which is a precarious situation to breach because some of these matters are very confidential. But I do have excellent credibility with law enforcement. And again, I was in prison for nonviolent crimes.
Right.
They vouched for me to another agency. I wrote repeatedly to the agencies investigating Durst saying, look, you know, it's time for me to tell you what I know. Thank God. You know, he's finally being looked at and hopefully prosecuted. I'll tell you, you know, what I know might not amount to much. I can't prove some of it, but there's other parts I think I can prove. And there's pictures out there if you know where to look for them. And I'll tell you where I stashed them last time I saw them, which is in a very good spot. So nothing really came of it. There wasn't a lot of interest. I ran it by my attorneys, no interest. Finally, I wrote Douglas Durst. I wrote him at the Durst Organization. I told him about my credibility, who's going to vouch for me. My attorney's names, please send somebody from his from the Durst Organization or one of his attorneys or investigators to come see me. Well, that generated a visit from the FBI investigating Robert Durst. And they came and literally I felt like they were treating me like a suspect. Now, I was a law clerk in prison. I know a little bit about the Miranda warning. When you give somebody custodial interrogation, you have to Mirandize them.
Right.
Well, because I was inviting them there all along to speak to me, even though I was in prison, it still doesn't fall under custodial interrogation because I was free to go. I can go back to my cell. I can tell the officer, hey, I'm done talking to these guys and, you know, I'd like to go back to my cell. Well, they Mirandized me right away. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. I'm a cooperating witness. I've done this before. I've been down this road. I know federal agents very well. I've never been Mirandized. Why are you treating me like a suspect? I didn't kill Susan, you know? And they said, oh, well, that's just policy from New York field office. It changed since you this and that. And I said, wait a minute. Didn't New York field office just interview or interrogate Hillary Clinton about certain matters? And then she got lying to Congress and she's never been charged with that. But didn't New York field office interrogate and interview Hillary Clinton? They said, yes, we did. I said, did they Mirandize her? He told me, no, we didn't. I said, what the hell do you treat me like a suspect for Mirandizing? I said, all due respect, gentlemen, this interview is over. You want to speak to me again? You can go through my attorneys. I said, and off the record, he did it. I know for a fact he did it. I have recordings and some photographs of other things he's done. And Delilah, and I gave them her real name, was just as involved. But you blew your chance at interviewing me because now you're making me paranoid. I don't want to be Mirandized. I was in jail under the name Jason Smith in Miami at the time of Susan Berman's murder. I'm completely alibied. I did not do it. So you should have checked that out first before you started to treat me as a suspect in her murder. So that's the feeling I got. And I kind of knew the different permutations of law that apply to a Miranda warning. And I was very reluctant to speak to them. I said, look, even if I screw something up on the timeline, you guys could treat it as a lie to a federal agent and I get in trouble. So, you know, we can talk maybe in another time, but right now I'm going to invoke my right to counsel.
You write about the role that Jeanine Pirro, a district attorney and then a judge, but we know her as Judge Jeanine Pirro, and New York State investigator Joe Becerra. Tell us about their involvement. I know that Jeanine Pirro, you write that she wrote a book called They Killed Them All, I believe a few years ago, 2015, I believe. So tell us about her role in this incredible story.
Jeanine Pirro was the prosecutor in Westchester County, New York, the county where Robert Durst actually killed Kathy. And for years, and I know from many inside sources, she basically sat on her hands. And these people sit on their hands because of the wealth of Douglas Durst and the Durst organization, the power. They are billionaires. They have, you know, enormous political influence. They donate to certain causes that these people support. I'm not directly saying that any of these people took bribes directly or even indirectly, but I do know from insiders that one prosecutor after another, including Jeanine Pirro, pretended there was never enough evidence to indict him years ago for killing Kathy and let him slide. And then somebody else would get elected and they would let him slide. And I know from people very, very close to this and family members of, you know, certain people involved that this is what's been happening going on 40 years now. And then finally, the new prosecutor there indicts him when he's on his deathbed from COVID after being convicted in California.
Yeah.
So the family, the poor family has got no justice for him murdering Kathy Durst, although the evidence has been there all along to convict her, to convict him.
What we didn't talk about, when we talk about the incredible wealth, he was considered a weirdo and maybe even dangerous to his own family. And so they cut ties with him in 2006. And just to demonstrate the wealth that we're talking about, $65 million to go away. So this guy had the kind of wealth that only some people even possess. And at the same time, the family, regardless of whether they are disconnected to him, he still has the Durst name. So as you say, that it would be probably exerting as much pressure as they could to avoid that incredible bad publicity and a mark on their good name.
Yep, that's exactly right. They're a very, very powerful family. They may be good people, but they've been covering up for a murderer. Not just in my opinion, there's so many things that point to this. This family has been running interference. They have not helped the victims, Kathy's family members in any way, shape, or form. And unfortunately, this is about to be drugged big time through the media again, because there is so much out there that the chance of them being sued literally any day now and or facing racketeering charges, from what I hear from behind the scenes, racketeering charges at a minimum of civil racketeering, civil action, which civil racketeering can be converted into a federal prosecution for racketeering. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes right now that you're not hearing too much about. I'm sure you've heard that there's a pending and looming litigation going on against his estate now, unfortunately, because under California law, his conviction, because he was pending appeal, is now cleared off his slate. Robert Durst is now cleared. He's no longer a murderer, even though he was convicted of murdering Susan Berman a few months ago. But this is the system. This is the system of justice in this country where the wealthy get one tier of justice and the rest of us, you know, this guy's doing, you know, life sentences for a burglary where they stole the knife or a gun. Because in Florida, that's considered an armed burglary. But this guy who murders people and spends $5, $6, $7 million on each case for a lawyer, beats case after case after case. John Lewin, the prosecutor, God bless him, bravo, you beat Robert Durst, you got him convicted. He was a frail old man dying on a stand. Basically, he was dying in front of us all during the trial. However, in my opinion, and this is again my opinion, John Lewin, the prosecutor, put out a statement, a 5-page affidavit to everybody, the investigators, witnesses, and then a public record, asking all the witnesses and investigators to stop talking to each other in all the other cases. You know, and this was in place for like 3 years, and this wasn't really highly publicized. Well, why would you do that? If you read through his affidavit, now there was speculation about why he would put something else out like that, but he was focused solely on his case, and he claimed he didn't want everybody contaminating testimony, either on purpose or inadvertently or on, you know, for money or for whatever reasons, not contaminating testimony in his case. So why would you stop the investigation and ask for it to be ceased into Kathy Durst's murder? Why would you ask for it to be ceased into Lynn Schulze's murder? That affidavit exists. I can supply that. I found that actually, somebody pointed me to it. I nearly fell over because everybody stopped talking. And I was told, look, we can't do interviews. We're not allowed to interview you for any of these murders right now that he did. And I was stunned. But that was at the request of John Lewin. He put out a request to everybody, a very formal request. He said he doesn't want the testimony contaminated until his case is over with. You know, I say if you have a serial killer, you prosecute him simultaneously in every jurisdiction. You charge him and investigate him every way you can. Why would you try to shortstop all these other people's investigations and all these family members that are suffering? It didn't make sense to me then. And as being a former law clerk, I just was so offended and hurt, and having come to know what beautiful people Kathy Durst's family members are and how hurt they were over a lot of things and these delays and being told one thing and then nothing happens for year after year. I mean, you know, her poor brother, Jim, he's suffered so long. He investigated. He provided so much evidence to authorities, so many witnesses and things he discovered and uncovered. And nobody would move on it. Everybody's terrified of the Durst money. They're terrified of it. You know, politically, you know, they're just all terrified of it in Westchester County.
It's a testament to what you say, which I've thought was very fascinating, and I mentioned this before, is the incredible amount of money and influence he had with attorneys. When you read the description of the evidence in the Morris Black case, and you realize that he was able to, with that attorney, to obtain an acquittal, and that's incredible.
Unbelievable, because dismembered him completely, and they never found the head, which would have, you know, supposedly shown what he did or didn't do, where the guy was shot.
Yeah.
Bottom line, he kills the witnesses against him. They're, you know, he's gone now. But the other one with a D, she's very, very dangerous. She's a loose cannon, and she just stands to inherit approximately $100 million right now. I have actually a second edition coming out in the next few weeks. It'll be out on or before April 1st, 2022, updated, revised edition of my Robert Durst book, Sex and the Serial Killer, will be out before April 1st of 2022. And in there, there's going to be things that have never been released before, not just my insider things, but documents that most of the world hasn't seen. They've been buried by these lawyers and these prosecutors. It's just a shame what's going on. There's also going to be a bunch of litigation. I do know this from the inside.
Yes.
I don't know what to say at this stage. It's just, it's heartbreaking to know what these people have gone through, that this man for 40 years has gotten away with Kathy Durst's murder, you know, number one, and then all these other intervening murders.
Do you think the lawsuit that's in, or one of the lawsuits that might be impending, one of the issues would be that there was the allegation that there was a leak? Obviously, there was some sort of leak, but an allegation that who had leaked information that led to Robert Durst realizing that Susan Berman was going to be re-interviewed about Kathy Durst.
My understanding is there is information coming out about that. These families and this money and their investigators and attorneys have had too many things relayed to them that put people's lives in danger, witnesses in danger, and including the leak with Susan Berman.
Now, you write about the media when there has been this opportunity to speak about this case, that your words were misconstrued. What words that you said and in what context were misconstrued in this case?
Oh God, there's been so many things. Can you clarify which one you're referring to? I don't recall at the moment.
I just mean that you had written that some of your words were misconstrued in the media. No example.
I do apologize. I have to go back to refresh my own memory on that, because there has been a few things along the way. I think one of the things that's irritating is that I think even it's in the description that my co-author wrote. I didn't write the description, where it said that we had, you know, fetish-fueled sex with prostitutes and whatever. And it was not me. It was him, of course, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but who's going to admit to that? But no, in reality, it was never me. It was always him with my girl upstairs. And I was trying to get out of there as quick as possible. I think the other thing was that at one point, somebody wrote was it a relationship with him? No, he came on to me and I basically strangled him.
Yeah.
So that's in the book. He's with several naked women. He's smoking a joint. He invites me to participate and is pointing at his, you know. So, yeah, I just dove on him and strangled him. I was a young, I don't know the pronunciation of the word.
Impetuous.
Yes. There you go. So, yeah, I just dove on him, strangled him, you know. There's another time. It's funny because in the basement, there was a hanging pipe that was the bane of my existence when I was a kid. And it was like more like a cellar. It was an unfinished cellar. And it was kind of painted and the old furniture down there. And either there or the upstairs apartment, which was very nice, is where we were. So one time the light, I didn't put it on in time for him. And he banged his head so hard on this hanging pipe, you know. And I was just so happy that he did that, because it was really made a big knot on his head.
Yes. So this has been a very fascinating account, and a very gripping account of your time with Robert Durst. And as you say, I guess, surprise to me and I guess our audience, that you will be having something with expanded information about Robert Durst. So we'll have to have you back on and talk about all those things that we didn't talk about in this interview. So I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Sex and the Serial Killer, My Bizarre Times with Robert Durst. Now, for those that might want to check out, you have a website, Facebook page. Tell us about how they might take a look at this information and another book that you mentioned already earlier.
Right. All my social media across the board is William Steele or William Steele Author. I would appreciate everybody going to my YouTube channel, William Steele Author, like as in writer, William Steele Author, and checking out the videos there. A lot of exposés about these matters we're discussing. And in my latest book, which is about my unfortunate relationship with Ghislaine Maxwell, which was short-lived, but there was a lot of consensual sex between her and I and her adult assistant. I get into some of that, her desire to have Jeffrey Epstein killed. So you'll hear some interviews that get into some of that stuff. And just we are now getting into this thing where I'm trying to start up a podcast, build my YouTube channel, William Steele Author, and we're working with the victims of wrongful incarceration, wrongful conviction, including Dr. Leslie Scholl, who was entrapped by a corrupt informant. He's now free. We're trying to help him get his medical license back and get exonerated. Dave Reinhardt, a California prisoner, who was entrapped and set up while people stole about $400 million inheritance from him. So my fiance, Dr. Mary, she's a forensic examiner, a fraud examiner. And so we're on the trail of some of these cases, and we're going to be doing a lot more stories and interviews. February 28th, 2022 edition of the National Enquirer. I'm on the full page just 2 weeks ago of the National Enquirer interview about the Ghislaine Maxwell story and my book about Ghislaine Maxwell. And that's called Ghislaine Sensational and Impure. And it's on Amazon. You can also find it through my website, williamsteeleauthor.com, or through even through the links that are shown at the on my YouTube channel. Again, William Steele Author on YouTube. Please like and subscribe. I'm trying to build that channel up, and we're going to probably be doing a 5-night-a-week radio broadcast, simultaneous stream from there. Again, having been incarcerated, this is all new to me, and I appreciate the opportunity to get the word out. And we're looking for cases of cold case murders, unsolved murders, family members that might want to be interviewed to tell their stories, get their stories out. And the podcast, again, we're going to be building that up, and the YouTube channel. So I thank you for your support, and I thank you for this opportunity to be interviewed. We support the victims. It's all about the victims. I put this in the beginning of all my books. All that's needed for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. That's a quote from Edmund Burke. I wasn't necessarily that good man. My heart was always good. I just went bad for a while. And the days of darkness have certainly caused me to see the light. You know, they call me the king of true crime now, the true crime king. So that's the moniker. If you Google that, you can Google my name, William Steele, with Prince Andrew, you know, with Ghislaine Maxwell, and you'll see many more articles and that YouTube channel. And thank you for your support.
Thank you so much. Sex and the Serial Killer, My Bizarre Times with Robert Durst. Thank you so much, William Steele. Good night.
Good night.